dancing straight.
I'm a little tired tonight.
All right. We are gathered together in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, the Son of God who has come in the flesh. And our incarnational introduction for today is from Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 5. Therefore, entering into the world, he is saying, sacrifice and offering you didn't want, but you designed a body for me. Therefore, entering into the world, he is saying, is the author, that is the author of Hebrews, his commentary on what was happening here. And sacrifice and offering you didn't want, but you designed a body for me, is the beginning of the quotation from Psalm 40. Note that as he, speaking of the Lord Jesus Christ, is entering into the world, he's saying high-level doctrine like this. Sacrifice and offering you didn't want, but, and this is how he entered into the world, you designed a body for me. The Son speaking to the Father, saying that he had designed a body for him. In his deity, he says this as he enters into the world. In his humanity, you see that he received that body. So we have both the deity and the humanity of the Lord Jesus Christ here in Hebrews 10:5. With that, we are in Genesis chapter 13 tonight, and this is a rather straightforward chapter, and there's not a lot to explain. And at the same time, it is a briefer chapter, shorter chapter, so I don't imagine that we will be taking a long time to talk about the contents here. So let's just begin at verse 1, 18 verses, verse 1. And Abram went up from Egypt, he and his wife, and all that were his, and Lot with him, to the south land. Abram, still being called Abram here, not Abraham, he goes up from Egypt. You will remember that last week, we left Abram in Egypt, and the difficulties of his own designs that he encountered there in while he was in Egypt, and Pharaoh sends him away forcibly out of the confines of Egypt. So he leaves Egypt, and he went up from Egypt to the south land. How can you go up to the south land? Well, there's a way that you can do that biblically. It's almost always, this is one of the few times actually that we would say that the direction that he's going, which is north, we would usually call that going up, and the Bible wouldn't necessarily do that. It would usually, especially in the New Testament, call that going down. But the Southland, I didn't make a mistake when I said he was going north, he's going to the Southland of the land of, at that time, called Canaan, later that Israel would inherit, called the Negev. The Negev means the south part of that land. And so the south part of the land that is east and north to Egypt, where the last events took place, he goes up from below to the southern part of Canaan. And Abram was very rich in livestock and in silver and in gold. And he went in his travels from the southland and until Bethel. So verse 1 lands him in the southland. Now he goes from the southland and he goes north until Bethel, which means house of God, until the place where his tent was at the start, between Bethel and Ai, or just Ai. And you will remember probably, was it last week, at the beginning of last week's chapter, that he pitched his tent, yeah, probably so, between these two locations. So he goes back to where he started, to the place of the altar which he made at the first. And there Abram called on the name of Yahweh. This is not the first time. You will recall that it's not saying that this is when he believed or when he was saved. He's already done this at that altar that he had made when he was there before. And verse 5, to Lot also, or Lot in Hebrew, the one going with Abram, there was sheep and oxen and tents. And the land couldn't bear them to dwell together because it was that their acquisitions were abundant and they weren't able to dwell together. And there was strife between those tending the livestock of Abram and those tending the livestock of Lot. And the Canaanite and the Perizzite then dwelt in the land. So this is some necessary background. This is some of the scene socially, geographically, and relationally between Lot, even financially, that their situation as far as their acquisitions were concerned. And Abram said to Lot, in verse 8, please, let there be no conflict between me and you, and between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, because we men are brothers. Note, this is the reason for peace. Whenever in a church situation you're dealing with brethren, and there is some kind of conflict, some sort of strife, there is something that has one at odds against another, or both in friction, we are brothers, we are brethren, we are sisters, we are brother and sister, we are all children of God. It ought to be the only reason. It's not the only reason that there is, but it ought to be the only reason that you need to bury the hatchet, as we say, and to come to grips with what would bring for peace. Now, in the case here where Abram is speaking with Lot, they are brethren in the literal sense. This is uncle and nephew here. So, all the more when those relationships will last forever. If you have a uncle-nephew relationship today, and that uncle, let's say, is a believer and the nephew is not, you could say this. Abram said this. He said, let there be no strife between us because we are related. But when one of those parties dies, even just one of them will die, if one is a believer and the other is not, that relationship is gone. I suppose you could say, unless before the second dies, they believe, then they're never going to be together again for the rest of eternity future. that's not that salient of a relationship. James tells us that our lives on this earth are a vapor. So you live for a vapor and you're related to somebody for a vapor. And then you die and you go separate ways. Then this really isn't that powerful. It's not that strong. It's not that real. But that's the level upon which Abram is reasoning with Lot, and it's correct, and it's valuable, and it's valid. Well, how much more when you are closer in relationship, not, you know, further beyond the nuclear family of uncle and nephew, but you are brother and brother, or sister and sister, or brother and sister, but in a relationship that will last forever. Now, I guess the most powerful, the most arguable, the most militant of a argument that you would have along these lines is if you were both. If you were related physically in the flesh, but you were related in spirit as well in the person of the Lord Jesus Christ, there are many other reasons, biblical reasons, scriptural reasons, Bible reasons, Christocentric reasons, Christ reasons, why we should be at peace. But this would be enough. We are brothers. So Abram says to Lot in verse 9, "Isn't the whole land before you? Please, be parted from upon me. If to the left, then let me go right, and if the right, let me go left." This is an example of what we've been talking about on our last couple Lord's Day installments in our study of the Lord Jesus Christ by means of the book of Romans. Abraham, we can call him Abraham, but here Abram is living in that example that we've been talking about not thinking about your own concerns, not thinking only about yourself. Last week in Romans 12:3, not thinking about yourself at all, but emptying yourself of self, as the Lord Jesus Christ did, as our ultimate and perfect example, and considering others better than ourselves. That's what Abram does here. He goes up to some point, and we will see in a moment, that you could see the whole land from this spot. And he basically says to Lot, is not the whole land before you? You take whatever part of this you want, and I'll take whatever's left. He's really not thinking about himself at all here. And you can afford to do that when you know that God is your Father. In verse 10, on the next page, "And Lot lifted his eyes and saw." I stress, saw. I'm not reading that. That's not an infinitive absolute. That's my own emphasis there. He saw the whole of the environs of the Jordan, because all of it was well watered before Yahweh's destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. So that's coming up. And Moses, who is writing this, knows, all right, I'm going to be telling you about this, and everybody knows that that land is destroyed. It's good for nothing now. So he's giving you this historical insight that there was a time when that was not the case, these environs of Jordan, because it was before Yahweh made it that way. It was like the garden of Yahweh, that is, like Eden, like the land of Egypt as you go to Zoar. So there was a place that everybody knew, Zoar, and its relation to Egypt, and this land was lush. This land was green. This land was very suited for the things that cattle and cattlemen need, that herds or flocks and shepherds need. It was well watered, and that meant, okay, our animals will have water. We won't have to be wandering around looking for water, digging wells, and pulling the water up out of these wells and keep putting them into troughs that we have made so as to water these animals. We can just go down, we can lead them to a river, much easier, much more convenient, much more comfortable if you did dig a well and you put this water down there and you're hoisting this up on a pulley, or if you're actually to different motions, right? Different functions, muscularly. If you've got this well and it's connected to a pulley and you're pulling down like this, you're using the backs of your arms and these big muscles in your back. But if you don't have that pulley and you're pulling up like this, you're still using those back muscles, but you're using your biceps. And water is heavy, and it's going to be a chore. The first bucket won't be bad. The second one won't either. The third, the fourth, as they go on, they get worse and worse, and you've got flocks or herds to water. So Lot looks down, he sees there's water everywhere. Won't have to do this. Won't have to walk around thirsty, not knowing where we're going to find water at. It's green because of that water. That is, they can graze. Before I began, I said, this is an example of why tapes are better than CDs. And if you missed that, it is forever gone. You will never hear my reasoning. But I listened to this tape on the way down, and I thought, well, this is spiritually, this is appropriate. This is a compilation of some of the works of Bach, done by the Philadelphia Orchestra here. And just before I came here, the song title was "Sheep May Safely Graze." And I thought, that's what we're going to provide, an environment where the sheep may safely graze. And then I started on the next one after that was "Sleepers Awake." I thought that might be appropriate as well. But sheep may safely graze. Lot looks, and he is thinking about himself and about his herds. He makes a decision. I want you to note the language in verse 11. And Lot chose for himself. Exactly. Motive is in question. And in verse 10, that word "saw" that we stress. So what Lot did was he chose selfishly and according to sight. And as we go on, verse 11, and Lot chose for himself all the environs of the Jordan, and Lot pulled up stakes toward the east. We explained last week this pulled up stakes idea. And they were parted, a man from his brother. Abram dwelt in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelt in the cities of those environs, and tented as far as Sodom. So he goes down into this Jordan Valley, into the environs of that valley. And he sees that it's plush, it's lush, it's green, it's luxuriant. But there are also more people there. I think it's interesting, it's just a little bit interesting, it's not something I want to spend a lot of time on, but it's interesting like this. It's a geographical and sociological thing, and Rick Riley, who was a sociology major, and he had a lot of geography as he would need to teach in post-elementary education, if I'm not mistaken, about his major. He summed these things up for me. He told me people, it used to, before technology got the way it was, cities were built around water. People need water just like animals need water. And civilization developed around water sources, fresh water sources. And thus, you can expect to find more settlers around those Jordan environs because the Jordan is running down there. I think even in Egypt today, to a large degree, you've got desert, but you've got the Nile cutting right through it. And the cities are built right along the Nile. Civilization is along that river. So this is where civilization was. Wherever you have cities, you have more people, so you have more flesh, so you have more fleshly activity, and you have those more people reacting in the flesh to the things that others have initiated in the flesh. But there's flesh everywhere. Someone recently spoke to me about a situation here in Indiana, and because this was a Chicagoite, and they were surprised to hear that we had a certain form of evil here in Indiana that exists everywhere. I didn't think you'd have that in Indiana, they said, and it's rampant in Indiana. It's because people have flesh in Indiana. The sinners live in Indiana. It's everywhere you want to go, it's going to be like that. But when you get a lot of them together, the degree of evil tends to accelerate exponentially because one is bouncing off another, that are bouncing off all of the relationships that they have around you. With more people, there generally comes more sin. And so in verse 13, "And the men of Sodom were evil ones and great sinners against Yahweh." That is, they were accomplished sinners against Yahweh. They had perfected sin to an art form, and they had gotten into sins that weren't just evil, but unnatural. Now, you're going to see that coming up, and we all know about Sodom's sin. I think everybody here has read far enough into Genesis to know what kind of thing went on in Sodom. But you know, in Ezekiel, when God gives His commentary on Sodom, He doesn't mention the thing that you think of Sodom as being guilty of. It even takes its name, sodomy, from the city of Sodom. He talks about arrogance. Talks about pride and fullness of bread coupled with no willingness to help those who were poor. So, rich, arrogant selfishness is what God tagged Sodom's sin to be. He doesn't even mention the homosexuality in Ezekiel when he's talking with Ezekiel about Sodom. So, he does mention it. It's not as if to say, I heard somebody one time say, you know, in Ezekiel, when God is speaking, He doesn't even mention homosexuality because homosexuality is just an alternative preference. It's not, God made them that way, so He doesn't talk about it. Well, He talked about it in Genesis, and He talks about it in Leviticus, and He talks about it in Exodus, and He talks about it in Deuteronomy, and He talks about it in Romans, and He talks about it in 1 Timothy. He labels this as perversion. It is sin, like all other sin, but it is having this on top of it, that it is unnatural sin. But it is true that that's not the main thing about Sodom. It was enabled to be that way because of its extreme arrogance. Like, it could do anything that it wanted to. It was always right. So we can talk about pride, fullness of bread, no openness to help those who were poor, those who were without, and homosexuality. Homosexuality to a level, I don't want to get into it now, we'll get into it when we see it in the actual account in Genesis, but you know about that. All right, now I want to point this out to you. Given what we've read in the paragraph, that is verses 10 through 13 now, you know what's going to happen. Lot made a decision that was selfish. Now, you might make the same kinds of decisions. You might make the same kinds of decisions all the time. Most of the decisions we make, maybe that's not even the case. The more spiritual we are, that would not be the case. But if we're just talking about on a personal level, that is, if your decisions don't involve anybody else, or you think that they don't, those kinds of life decisions, like maybe where I'm going to live, or where I'm going to work, or I'm going to go to school, or I'm not going to do that, or I'm going to go to this one as opposed to that one, or I'm going to take this course of study, or whatever it is. I'm going to go into business. I could think about doing this, that, or the other thing. I think I'll take that. You know, those kinds of decisions that you don't actually have a person or a group of people in mind, like they don't, it's actually very difficult to make a decision that doesn't affect any other human being. We are social beings, and you are going to be brought into the company of people based on those decisions. If you decide another way, you're going to be brought into the company of a different group of people, and if they're decisions like the ones I've just mentioned, you don't even know those people yet. Like, when you make those decisions in your heart, you don't even know the people that you're going to meet. But in that you decided on option A, it's going to open you up to a certain circle of acquaintances that if you chose B, you would not be with those people, but you'd be with a different group, the B group of people. But you may make those kinds of decisions without thinking about how it affects someone else, because especially if you're single, then those decisions, they're just, you have to make a decision about that. But it's very difficult to find decisions like that. Very difficult to find decisions that don't, to think of decisions, choices that don't involve anybody else. We have networks of other people, and in a church situation where we nurture body life, and when we actually try to generate instances of fellowship, and when our lives are enmeshed with each other, generally those decisions will affect the body in one way or another. And so we shouldn't think exclusively about self, and that's been a real theme these days without my really trying. So maybe we can say God is doing that. But let's say you have decisions that don't affect anybody except yourself. They're you, and they don't affect anybody adversely, so you don't have to worry about that, and it's all a matter of, will I do this or that? we're a third, and you're going to bear the ramifications, the implications of choosing that way or another. When you do that, you will probably decide, and again, I even balk at saying this because you shouldn't be thinking that way, but you can decide based on, again, if nobody else is going to be affected, based on what's going to be best for me. And you can really choose according to what you think would be the best thing for you, and it turn out to be horrendous. Lot chooses like that. Lot chooses, he sees, and he chooses based on comfort, he chooses based on convenience, he chooses based on the welfare of his flocks, and that can convert into the welfare of his family and his own prosperity. And he is choosing to go to the absolute worst place, maybe on the earth at the time, though the earth was pretty bad at that time. And you say the earth, the world is getting worse and worse. Yeah, it is. But there were pockets of time where the earth was pretty bad. And maybe you want to live at least in the place that we live in at this time, rather than some other place and some other time. If the world is progressively getting worse, then we would say as deep as we are into things, it ought to be just numerically just multiplied worse than it was way early. Well, this is very not that long after the flood. God says, had enough of this, wipes out the whole earth. Literally, that is the way I've translated it, right? When he says that he will destroy the earth. He's wiped out the earth. He's wiped out man and animals from off the earth, except this remnant floating above the earth's surface on this water. And he starts all over with them. As soon as they get off the ark, they're up to no good. The descendants of Ham, Shem, Japheth. And we see Babel, and we saw that in Genesis 10. And this is way back in human history, and you've got a whole city that is going to storm the house of one of its residents to have a homosexual gang rape kind of situation with these men that they don't know are angels. But again, we're getting ahead of ourselves. But my point is, Lot doesn't make a choice based on, I think this will be really bad. Lot sees something, makes a choice for that something based on himself and what he thinks will be good for him. And this is just going to turn out to be the worst thing for him and his family. He's going to end up with children of incest through his daughters and his wife back there as a pillar, a statue of salt because of his traveling to Sodom. And this is the very beginning, this is the germinal form of all of those decisions that Lot will make. This is the first of them. I think I'll go down and live there. I always say it, nobody gets married because they think this is going to be bad. They think that I'm going to live happily ever after. You know, I've been singing, someday my prince will come, and here he is, and if your one is a woman. And, you know, this, all of the songs, they can't seem to come up with anything unique as to topic, and it always has to do with boy-girl love situations. And you get married to this person who is the, you know, woman of your songs or whatever, and Nobody ever chooses that, thinking this will be bad. They think it's going to be good all the time. And why wouldn't you? I mean, we're not saying that you should choose something that you think will be bad for you. But it's kind of converts a lot of times into this kind of situation where I thought this would fulfill me. I thought this would give me pleasure. I thought this would be security. I thought this would be satisfying. It was anything but. And thus, when we choose, when we make decisions at every step of that decision-making process and at every new decision in that vein or that direction of choices, it must be submitted to God. It must be subject to the Lordship of Jesus Christ, because we don't know the future. We don't know what's going to happen. And note also at this point where Lot in verse 12 simply tented as far as Sodom. He is still living in tents on the outskirts of Sodom. As he goes there, gradually he will develop relationships, mercantile relationships. His daughters will develop romantic relationships, or at least marital contracts with people, because he has two sons-in-law. They are betrothed to, his daughters are betrothed to these future sons-in-law, but they're not actually married yet. We will see that later in Genesis again. But all of these contractual and friendship and social and business relationships are being made now with the people of Sodom. We'll get to it. I just want to put this idea in your mind now, because we're going through the book of Genesis. So let me just plant this idea in your mind, and you can pick it up later, and I will be sure to remember to tell you about it later, and you will recall what we're saying tonight, that today it's just, that looks good, and he goes down in tents on the outskirts of Sodom. You're going to see a gradual entrenching process so that he is actually even elevated, promoted within Sodom. We will, when we get there, chart Lot's decline as a warning for us. So let's go to verse 14. And Yahweh said to Abram after his parting from Lot, "Pray, lift your eyes and see from the place where you are, northward and southward and eastward and toward the sea." I told you that as Lot parts from him, they were at a place where they could see all that land. As Lot leaves, God tells Abram, look in every one of our four directions of the compass, and all of this land, he is saying, verse 15 will be given to him, because all of the land that you are seeing, I will give to you and to your seed until forever. Le'olam. Four or two, or until, maybe it's not le'olam, but all the olam, but into perpetuity. This is yours now, to you and your seed. Also, pray, that sounds so archaic up there in verse 14. Nah. And God doesn't ask anybody, please, I guess. So I had to go ancient, had to go in antiquated on you here. It's difficult to tag nah in Hebrew when God is saying it. So he says, let me suggest to you this. Look around everywhere. That's the other thing. I can't say suggest to you because it's a command. He's God. But, you know, look around every way that you can see. All that you see is given to Abraham and his seed. Verse 16, and I will establish your seed as the dust of the earth. That if a man was able to number the dust of the earth, your seed also will be numbered. Now, while seed is singular in each of these instances, I don't capitalize it because he's not going to have numerous multiplied Jesuses. You know what I mean? That you must look at the context. Last week, we had a place where seed was singular. We took the lead of the Apostle Paul and made much of that, and we spoke about the singular seed being the Lord Jesus Christ, to whom the promises were made, along with Abram, or Abraham. Also, though, in this case, those numerous seed, that all of the, like if you can count the stars, you're counting individual stars. That means you're counting individuals that are called the seed of Abraham, but it's still singular. Because you become such by being in the one seed by belief on the Lord Jesus Christ. Verse 17, arise, walk in the land to its length and to its width, because I will give it to you. This is the land grant aspect of the covenant. That is, from where Abram stood, from that spot, he talked about, I'm going to give you this that you can see. He's not talking about Rome. He's not talking about the United States. He's not talking about beyond the sea. He's just saying, this land right here, everywhere, that way, this way, and to both sides, I'm giving you that land. So there, this was part of the Abrahamic covenant, the land inheritance side of that, that issue. Verse 18, and Abram removed his tent and went and dwelt at the oaks of Mamre, which are in Hebron. So this town, Hebron, and he's going to pretty much live there in Beersheba. But he dwelt at these oaks of Mamre. And he built an altar there to Yahweh. Now, when we read those last words in that paragraph, that very short paragraph, that sentence in that chapter, this is what I want to call a retrospective presage. A presage is when something is foreshadowed or something is hinted at, something you get an inkling, you get some indication of something that will be future. It's not a straight-out prophecy. It's not verbalized in so many words, but it's a hint at something that's coming up. Now, a retrospective presage is almost an oxymoron. You want to say, you can't do something in retrospect, that is, as you look back on something, because that's the opposite of a presage. I'm still going to call this a retrospective presage, as oxymoronic as I know that that might sound. Because as we look back to this from our vantage point, we see the significance of what this pointed to. That is, from our standpoint in time, we look back to that, but to go that far back, we've got to go back to the cross, which was future to Abram. And thus, any time, and we talked about this a little bit last week, that you see an altar, that altar is heralding into the future when the Lord Jesus Christ will die on the altar that Hebrews 13 says that we have. That those who ate at the time when the temple was still standing from the sacrifices of the literal altar that presaged this real one don't have a right to eat from. So we look back as if it is looking in the future from Abraham's time, and we have this retrospective presage of Jesus Christ and Him crucified. Note that every time you'll see Abraham do this all through Genesis. He is a man, as one person put it, a man of the altar. That is, every place he goes, he leaves his mark there by leaving behind him an altar. It would be like stones, like this one, mounded up with as flat a surface as you could get so as to slay victims and burn them to God there. So he would leave one of these stone mounds, altars, everywhere he went. And he called on Yahweh in connection with an altar. That's what we do. We have no access at all to God if it is not through the sacrifice of the Lord Jesus Christ and the Lord Jesus Christ Himself, through whom we have received access to God. There is absolutely no access to God outside of the New Testament altar, the cross, and the cross. The cross was nothing if it was not for the victim that died there. The Lord Jesus Christ, the only mediator between God and men. So we have another chapter for the books, Genesis chapter 13. And let me exhort you from what may be the most practicable point to make your life decisions wisely. Choose with prudence, because sometimes the things that look so good on the surface hold within them an unseen danger. The one having ears to be hearing, let him be hearing.